Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, and Koinos Hermes, as well as a deep bow to Sophia, Gaia Sophia, Cosmic Sophia. We have a delightful guest. I'm super excited about our guest today because one of his books, when I taught philosophy of mind, we had some really great books to read. And when I asked students what their favorite was, the majority of them picked one of this author's books, Carl Safina. And he is a delightful writer. Carl Safina's lyrical nonfiction writing explores how humans are changing the living world and what the changes mean for non-human beings and for us all. His work fuses scientific understanding, emotional connection, and a moral call to action. His writing has won a MacArthur Genius Prize, Pew, Guggenheim, and National Science Foundation fellowships, book awards from Lanan, Orion, and the National Academies, and the John Burroughs, James Beard, and George Rabb medals. He grew up raising pigeons, training hawks and owls, and spending as many days and nights in the woods and on the water as he could. Safina is now the first endowed professor for nature and humanity at Stony Brook University and is founding president of the not-for-profit Safina Center. He hosted the PBS series Saving the Ocean, which can be viewed free at pbs.org. His writing appears in the New York Times, Time Magazine, The Guardian, Audubon, Yale E360, and National Geographic, and on the web at Huffington Post, CNN.com, Medium, and elsewhere. Safina is the author of 10 books, 11 now, including the classic Song for the Blue Ocean, as well as New York Times bestseller Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. That was the one I used in Philosophy of Mind, alongside a book by the Dalai Lama, a book by Gregory Bateson, and a book by Francisco Varela, along with Evan Thompson and Eleanor Roche. His most recent books are Becoming Wild, How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace, very philosophical things. That's Animal Culture as Wisdom, Love, and Beauty. And most recently, Alfie and Me, What Owls Know, What Humans Believe. He lives on Long Island, New York, and his wife, Patricia, and their dogs live there with him, along with their feathered friends. Carl, welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, my friends. Really great to have you here.
Thanks. Really great to be here with you.
Everybody, I want to say this is one of my favorite books of philosophy, Carl's most recent book. Now, I thought that Beyond Words was also a wonderful book of philosophy. This one is equally delightful. It's just a marvelous work of philosophy.
Thank you.
Reminds me a little bit of, do you ever hear of The Philosopher and the Wolf?
I'm sorry, who?
The Philosopher and the Wolf.
Oh, The Philosopher and the Wolf. No, I'm afraid I haven't, but I think it's something I would be very interested in by the title.
You would. Actually, you really would enjoy that book. And it's very similar to your book in certain ways. And it's beautiful because one of the things that's ironic about it is it's written by Mark Rylance, who's a well-known, well-respected philosopher of science, you know, focuses on cognitive science and how mind works, and really takes an embodied, embedded approach to mind, an active cognitive approach. Mm-hmm. And yet, so this book, which is about the meaning of life and happiness and relationship and relationality, he says, well, this isn't actually technically a work of philosophy. Mm-hmm. So his other, even though it's so richly philosophical, just as your book is, and that's mm-hmm. what's so beautiful is I disagree with him as much as I think he's a good philosopher, and it shows where I think philosophy has gone wrong, which we'll get into a little bit later. But let's just start start with this beautiful story of you and this little foundling.
Yeah. Well, it was a while ago. It was right before the COVID pandemic shut everything down. Somebody found a very young baby screech owl on their front lawn, very close to death, and probably had been dragged out of the nest by some kind of predator, maybe a crow or something like that, and just dropped somewhere. There was no obvious nesting tree nearby. The little baby was very close to dying, as I mentioned. That person called a wildlife rehabilitator who happened to be a person I worked with and a person who was pet sitting for us from time to time. So a person I knew well. And that person knew that I had a lot of experience with wildlife rehabilitation, with keeping birds of various kinds, including things like hawks and owls. So they called me, and together we worked a bit to stabilize this little baby. And we started calling her she, even though we would not know the gender for well over a year. But she started to thrive, and it was all looking really good for what is called a soft release, where the creature is not caged and just starts to basically, you know, find their wings like a normal wild bird and then wanders off. And it looked like that was going to happen within 2 or 3 weeks of us getting her. But then she had a serious flight delay, probably caused by the fact that she had nearly died of starvation before that person found her. And the delay was that the feathers in her wings that would allow her to fly, the long feathers, did not come in on schedule. And from past experience, I was afraid that if that happened to a bird that almost died as a nestling, then she might also not molt properly. And so I held her. It was totally unplanned, but I needed to keep her in what I called protective custody until she molted and got her new set of feathers, and the winter passed into spring, when suddenly being free and being able to fly would be a more viable prospect for her. So there was a lot of time for us to get to know each other, for a bond to develop, and for me to grow extremely fond of her, I have to say, before I started opening that door and getting her in shape for the time when eventually I was going to just leave that door open and leave it up to her. In a way, that's all the preamble to the story. And in a way, the story begins after she starts her own free living life.
Mm-hmm. And we should note here that Carl's not just an ordinary nature lover, but you have a PhD, you're an ecologist, you have training in wildlife rehab. And so it's you're kind of attuned to be able to and trained to be able to handle the situation. I think it will evoke for some people my octopus teacher, which is a delightful a visual kind of experience of this sort of relationship, this close relationship that most people don't get to have, because you ended up spending 5 hours a day just observing this bird and really and bringing to realization, maybe in a deeper way, the kinds of things that you've written about before, which have to do with recognizing mindedness and recognizing a philosopher would say personhood in a way, because sometimes we think people just equates to human. But if we recognize that there's a who in there, not the who of an owl's but a person in there, there is a subjectivity that can think and respond and recognize that we are developing a relationship with a person.
Well, we're certainly developing there's a few things to say based on what you just said, but let me pick up from the end of that. Certainly developing a relationship with a sentient being, a sentient individual. I like to sort of stay away from the personhood way of talking about things, because that's actually an entirely legal argument. And the biological, emotional, intellectual capacity of other minds really runs much deeper than this legality about whether a non-human is or can be or should be a person, which is entirely about basically legal rights and captivity. It's not really about the capacities of other minds that have evolved over the last 3.5 billion years that life has been on our planet. So really, the kinds of things that I'm interested in are vastly deeper than the much more recent arguments over non-human personhood.
Yeah, and I would clarify there. I wasn't referring to that either. That obviously grows out.
Yeah, I understand that entirely. I do understand that entirely.
Yeah, from a philosophical point of view, that is exactly the way to characterize it. That it, when we're talking about the philosophical nature of personhood as opposed to this legal application, which is part of what sometimes philosophers try to do, is offer legal theorists a way to try to, for instance, litigate things that would be beneficial for the world, whether it's ecological or otherwise. But yes, the deeper questions are the ones that I'm referring to. And I appreciate how those appear in your work and how they must have manifested in this relationship with another sentient being.
Yeah. And you mentioned something about past experience that I've had. It's been a life for me, really. When I was a small child, my father raised canaries in our little apartment in Brooklyn. And I, was able to observe at point blank range, very, right up at my nose, the lives of these little birds, them courting and mating, laying and caring for the most impossibly tiny eggs, the even more impossibly tiny chicks. And then when I was 7 years old, a little boy, I started raising homing pigeons. And when you're that age, you have a lot of time to stand around just observing and just getting to know them as individuals and watching how they conduct their lives and getting a sense of their perceptions, those kinds of things. When I got a little older, I got into falconry. And I started working with hawks and training them and actually becoming working partners with them. After that, I studied seabirds for a long time. And I spent a lot of time watching from inside a blind, as well as out on the ocean, but watching them at their nest, watching them courting and feeding each other, feeding their young ones, all that kind of stuff. Then I got into wildlife rehabilitation as sort of a side thing, because often people would find injured wildlife that needed help. And I was capable of helping some of them, some of the time anyway. And I helped to found a wildlife rehabilitation group that is actually still going on Long Island in New York, where I live. So I brought a lot to the table, when this baby owl was rescued.
Yeah, indeed. And at the same time, you were able to learn things that we might not necessarily think about, or even that some scientists might kind of. So for instance, as she, not that we have to skip into her story, but her mating behavior, for instance, was maybe not quite as mechanical as people might assume.
Yes, right, exactly. Right? So that was, I started to, so having all those experiences and bringing a lot of background to the brink of meeting this baby owl, I nonetheless started to be very surprised by the nuances and subtleties of what I was seeing. And you mentioned watching them 5 hours a day. So that's where COVID comes in, because I had nowhere that I needed to be. Everything got canceled. And yet in this like miraculous coincidence, that was the year that this baby owl, who we named Alfie, was free flying in our backyard. And I would just get up a little before dawn, go to where she was usually roosting, I'd locate her in the backyard, watch what she was doing until she went to her day roost. And then it's around sunset, I'd go to the day roost, watch her come out, watch what she was doing. That may seem like, you know, how can you watch that for 5 hours a day? But it was full of little tiny surprises, almost never the same. And then right away, she attracted a wild suitor. And that's when things got really interesting, because as you just said, what I saw was that her reactions were not the mechanical, what was called in how I was taught in class, fixed action patterns, that one of them does one thing in a very stereotyped way, and that evokes the stereotyped response from the other. And if the signal and the response are correct, then they do the next step in the courtship process. It just wasn't like that at all. The way it was that at first she didn't trust him at all. They would chase each other around the yard. I wasn't even sure if it was courtship or hostility for at least a few days or around a week or so. And then they started to settle down where she would like tolerate his presence without feeling alarmed. He would start to bring her gifts of food, usually a moth would be the easiest thing he could quickly go and find and come back to her. And sometimes she would not take it. They were not really, they certainly were not bonded. There was not a high level of trust. That took time to develop. And then I would see them just sitting comfortably and quietly, like on the same perch. Then he would go and bring her the moth, usually a moth, at that stage, and she would take it every time. They were getting closer. The relationship was becoming something, you know, more concrete. Then they would be sitting next to each other, and there was that physical contact that started to seem like it was becoming a key part of their interaction. And then she would come out of her day roost, go over to where I had put a nest box on the outside of my writing studio. I had seen her checking out some hollows in some trees in the backyard. So I put a nest box on the outside wall of my writing studio in a spot where I knew that no squirrels could get to it. I mean, it would really be a secure location. She liked that right away. And she would go over near the nest box and start calling for him, and he would come out of the woods. So over the period of about the first maybe month, it went from not knowing, not being able to recognize whether this was hostile or courtship, to her looking for him every evening and you know, actively evoking his arrival from wherever he was roosting during the day. And at that point, you know, I was watching a bonded pair, but it wasn't a mechanical thing at all. It was the development of an emotional bond and a relationship, and the parallels and how recognizable all of this was to me as a human being was really surprising. Even with the whole background that I had had, it still surprised me that everything about these owls was so nuanced. So like they really, you know, they knew what was going on with them, I guess is another way of saying it. It wasn't anything that was just mechanical instinct clicking through some set of procedures. It wasn't that at all. And that surprised me. And I was surprised that I was surprised, because I was thinking, you know, why don't I know this already? And anyway, so that became a very rich thing that really made watching them very fascinating right at the beginning of their first breeding season.
One of the other things that it was potentially surprising is that we're supposed to think, I guess, that we can't really read facial expression. And you've got an interesting picture where there's a kind of indication that even for someone who didn't know these two birds very well, that maybe it looks like we can.
Yeah, that was another thing that I was taught in class, that you cannot tell anything about the emotional state of a bird through their facial expression, because they have no facial expression. But yes, you can see in that photograph you're mentioning where she is on a branch about 1 foot in front of where her mate is, her mate, who we called Plus One. He was behind her. He was not tame, and he was not very comfortable with me being too close to them, my prying eyes. You can easily see in that photograph that, you know, he's really giving me a very alert gaze, and she's just fluffed up and leaning back, because she's literally in that photograph, she's between her two most trusted beings in the world, her mate and me, the person who, along with my wife mainly, we raised her, and she, you know, she trusts us 150%, and she trusts her mate, and she was feeling good, and you can just see how relaxed she is.
Yeah, it's a really great image. It's just, you just feel that she's smiling and that he's really just like got this eye on you, you know, like really he's all right, I'm watching you, Safina. It's a beautiful thing. What else surprised you? I mean, I think this is beautiful because of the fact, and I mean, there's a whole other layer too, because of course in the film My Octopus Teacher, we saw that really spending time with these beings could reveal behavior that people hadn't seen before, which is can be surprising when we think about ecologists going out there and studying things. But yeah, that's what happens. You know, my sister's a primatologist, and she saw chimps doing things that they weren't supposed to do. And it's just about if you have the time, and so sometimes you can see things in the field. Nevertheless, your doctoral level education left you with a certain impression that this experience challenged. And I think that's so beautiful to consider, that we can still be surprised. We can still experience real wonder in nature, including the wonder of surprise. Because sometimes the wonder comes from what you know, that a sunset is beautiful, but there's still a sense of wonder. But sometimes it's that, oh my goodness, nature still surprises us. There's still so much we don't know.
Right. Well, I think in a way that's a good analogy, because if you were asked to create a ranking of 1 to 10 of the four components of a sunset, and then fill in those blanks with ratings of 1 to 5, you know, what would you do? That's not the way a sunset works, and it's not the way we perceive it. But when we watch animals in a formal scientific sense, usually that's what you do. You turn their behaviors into some numbers that you can analyze. So I would have, if I was doing that in a scientific way, I would have done something along the lines of just based on what we were talking about, you know, count the number of times that there was a chase and note who's chasing who, and then count the number of times there was a food delivery, and maybe note how far apart they are on the branch when they're sitting on the same branch, or if they're not sitting on the same branch, how far apart they are during the hour I'm watching when both of them are in view. So you cut these things up into things where you can tick boxes and put numbers in. But of course, then what you lose is how things grade into each other and the range of things. And I was watching them with, in a sense, with the eye of somebody who is scientifically trained, but I wasn't doing science. I wasn't recording it in that way. I was recording it very descriptively, just through written notes, or if things were happening, I didn't want to take my eyes off them, I was recording it through voice recorded notes in a much more narrative way. That's a lot like some scientists have done their work, like Jane Goodall did that with the chimpanzees when she was first studying her chimpanzees. But other times, and other scientists in other contexts, it's all about creating categories and doing it in ways that you can rate things or rank things or measure things. That's the latter is more like how I worked when I was doing the more formal science studies that I used to do. And And this way of watching these owls was, it was different. I was watching them in a different way for a different reason. And like you've mentioned a couple of times, the movie and the story, My Octopus Teacher, an early possible title for my book was My Owl Teacher. And then the octopus movie came out and it was like, well, no, that title is gone. But it was a similar kind of thing because I was really learning quite a lot. And I felt that her tameness, the fact that she was not only completely uninhibited in my presence, but she just didn't spend any time or any energy watching me at all. I was a matter of fact thing that was just always around. That was like a portal into the wildlife of these owls. And it let me see and observe things that you would normally simply never be able to see.
Well, what else surprised you? What else did you, I mean, share something else.
There were some behaviors that were a lot more instinctual. When Alfie started to spend a lot of time in the box, you know, I realized that, and then I checked out to see that she had laid a clutch of eggs, and instinctually she incubated them for the right amount of time, and that was, you know, with no practice and no modeling. She had never seen that happen. She had never done it before, but she got it right. The same thing that happened when her young ones left the nest. The morning that they first left, she had never seen one of them out of the nest before. And, you know, she was like, what's going on here? Should I be near this one? Should I be back in the nest with the other ones? What should I do? When they all left, she went into the box one time, turned around and came out, and never went back into the box. But she seemed to be checking to, in some way, make sure, you know, and I don't know if she could have had an expectation or what, but it certainly seemed like she checked to make sure that there was nobody left in there. And then all of her attention was always focused on the young ones being out, which she was with those young ones for maybe 3 weeks after they were out, which is a thing that happens with those kinds of owls. The young ones don't just fly away. There's this extended period of parental care with them.
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that this is all unfolding. We've said you live on Long Island, but this is less than an acre, the property. And it kind of evokes, again, we had Doug Tallamy on the podcast. Huh? And the idea that, of course, that's a principal driver. He's increasing the number of caterpillars, moths, right? And that's something that the owls need. But that if we give back half of our yard, even a tiny one, because he documents cases of people with as small as a tenth of an acre, and yet they are able to blossom the biodiversity there by making sure they get the right kinds of things. And so this whole adventure of your soul and the soul of the world is happening within a 100-foot radius of home.
Pretty much. We're in a place that is, it's suburban. It's not exactly row houses. It's an old neighborhood. We have houses within a mile of us. We have maybe 20 houses that are between 200 and 300 years old. And then we have a lot of houses that were built probably in the 1960s. So it's a bit of a mishmash in that way. But we also have one little swamp between two streets where you might have plopped another row of houses if it was dry, but it's wet there. That runs into two small ponds that used to be a working mill pond back in like colonial times. And so the water and the wetness, and then against our yard, there's about 30 acres of woods. So there's some space. It's not all house, you know, against house, against house, against house, with everybody spraying and drenching it with pesticides all the time. It's not exactly like that. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, you know, you mentioned Doug Tallamy. So all about replanting with natives so that the native insects actually can do some recovering and repopulating. The woods behind our house, although it's about 30 acres there, they're in almost entirely non-native trees. They're mostly Norway maples. And right around our house in our backyard, what the owls would really need to do really well would be a good population of wild mice, mostly white-footed mice and voles where we live. And we don't have that because those non-native maples don't really produce the kinds of acorns and nuts and things like that that would normally support those native rodent populations. Less than half a mile away, there's another patch of woods that actually has a lot of those native trees in it. And that place is where my office is for my little not-for-profit group. I'm speaking from there to you right now. This house has a mouse problem. Half a mile away at my house where Alfie is, there's a dearth of mice because of those non-native trees. So it's really not that complicated, but for people, you just don't see it. You know, you look around, there's trees. You don't think about native insects, especially if you think that insects are bad, and all of that kind of stuff. The last couple of years, we have not mowed our front or back lawn during May. And we have an explosion of fireflies now. Fireflies are declining all over the place. And one of the problems is that the grass they like grasslands in the edges of woods. Most people either mow it or spray it or do both. And we've just, we've eased up on everything around our house. Our house is a very scruffy looking place. I've never used pesticides anywhere, no matter where I ever lived or what kind of garden I was trying to grow. Because when I was a teenager, I read Silent Spring and I just knew that we were poisoning the whole world. So I've never used any pesticides, but nonetheless, now, in addition to not using pesticides, we're not mowing for a good chunk of the year. And we have a whole bunch of bushes that are not very well manicured. And we have some natives that are reseeding themselves into our backyard, a couple of walnut trees, several young oaks, a bunch of wild cherries. And I've welcomed them. You know, I didn't say, oh, you don't belong there, I'm going to cut you down. I've said, wow, that's really good. You know, a cherry tree is going to be good for the mice. So we're watching all these young things grow up. And in the case of that walnut, that was the first wild thing that sowed itself in when I first got the house, which was about 18 years ago now. That tree is now quite big. It's more than 30 feet tall. It's been producing walnuts. And it's food for squirrels. So we have squirrels, and the squirrels are there. On their own, they belong there. They're native animals, and they also provide food for the hawks and owls. And all of these things connect all the time.
Mm-hmm. And there's a theme. There's so many things that are that you are able to do in this book that. I mean, for instance, you couldn't weren't really done in the documentary about the octopus, but just in general, you bring a lot of sensitivity and intelligence to thinking about this, including questions about philosophy in its social aspect, because philosophy is not just some kind of individual activity, but it is a cultural activity, and you're reflecting deeply about the nature of relationality, that we can have these relationships with non-human beings, that they might be important to us, and that this all together should get us to ask deep questions about how we're living and how we might live differently. Why is the dominant culture the way it is? What other cultures have thought differently and related differently with themselves, with each other, the people within the culture, and then with the larger community of life, what they would see as their larger family, their relations.
Mm-hmm.
Where can we start with that? I mean, I think it's such a profound set of questions, but I just recommend this book to people who are listening. This is a really beautiful meditation that integrates indigenous views and has some critical reflections about the dominant culture. Some of them, that's the place where I could have a little criticism, because everything is so beautiful, but I do think maybe there's a little tension in the way you think of Plato, which I think has been informed by the Academy, and I don't think that's Plato. I think that's how we got him. But maybe we can save that for a minute and just start with anything in that general zone of what our culture should be thinking about in terms of how do we actually live here in a way where we're going to survive and thrive? And what do we miss when we don't have these others in our community of life?
Well, if we got Plato wrong, nonetheless, that's how we got Plato. And that's, unfortunately, that's what matters. We can talk about that more if you want. But first of all, thank you for getting what I'm trying to do with this book, Alfie and Me. The framing for me was, here's a relational creature. She is capable of nuance, relationship, awareness. Why is that surprising to me when they've been in the world since before people were in the world? They were here when we got here. We should know this. Is it a limitation of human intelligence that causes us not to realize this? Where is our alienation from the living world originating? Is it just we're not smart enough, or are we taught our disconnect? Mm-hmm. So if we're taught our disconnect, a question is, what are other people taught? And that's what got me into looking at what are people taught about their relationship, the human place in the world, the human relationship with other things in what we call the natural world, which other people call the world. What do indigenous people teach about this? What do people in all the South Asian religions teach about it? What do East Asian religions and philosophies teach about it? This was a total exploration for me. I didn't really know anything about these topics when I got into it, but I got into it to help me answer this question. Where is our disconnect from? Is everybody saying the same thing? And the answer was absolutely not. Almost everybody is saying that the world is a sacred place, that everything that is holy is in the world, that the world is spiritual and material at the same time. But our culture, the West, which started mainly in Europe and arguably mainly with Plato, says something very, very different. And Plato's star student, Aristotle, also gave us the Scala Naturae, which tells us that, riffing off Plato's sense of the fact that the world is not a good place, not a nice place, that we should keep our attention only in our minds and our thinking, and focus our attention on the perfections we can imagine, which must have come from somewhere off this world outside of space and time. Then Aristotle says, you know what? Actually, also, humans are the only thing that matter in the world. The whole rest of the world is here just to serve us. We are better than the world. And why is this a big deal instead of something that was, you know, come and gone 3,000 years ago? Apparently, from what I can tell in the research that I did, it is largely because Plato's ideas, and these ideas that I'm discussing, found their way into the faith traditions, not just the faith traditions, but the faiths, the religious teachings of the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And the view of the world as not a sacred place, and that our attention should be on heaven and the afterlife, became matters of faith in our culture. So these views, even in their time, or in with other Greek philosophers, they were criticized in their time, but because they became articles of faith in our basic valuation of the world in the Western culture, we have alienated ourselves from the world by that thinking, in that thinking. That thinking alienates humans from the world. It teaches us that the physical world is not sacred and not holy, that other things have no inherent value. Their only value is if we can use them and how we can use them. And this has become a planetary catastrophe that is accelerating at this point, now that we have so many people operating in this way. In my lifetime, the human population has tripled, and everything has sped up in our search for bigger, faster, more. Almost no matter what it is, we want bigger, faster, more of it. And what are we taught about the world, not only about these sort of deeper questions of valuation, but the valuation comes to us implicitly from the time we're little. We're not taught to respect the world and other things very much. Then we go to school. We're not really taught about the natural world in school. In fact, when we graduate, we're handed our diploma and somebody says, "Congratulations, you've graduated from high school or college. You're done learning." And we know nothing about where our food comes from, where our water comes from, where our energy comes from, where any of the material that makes up our entire material existence originated, or where our garbage goes and our waste.
Or but where our happiness or peace come from.
We really know one thing. We've been taught one thing. We know how to shop and buy stuff.
That's right.
And what have we been made? We have not really been made into realized human beings or citizens. We've been made into consumers, and that's what we're called. We're called consumers because for most of the rest of the world, our only value is what we can buy from them. And for us, the world itself, its only value is how can we use it. And that's what I mean by a planetary catastrophe, because in basically the whole other history of the world and all of its other teachings was really different. It was about respect of the world and respect of the generations that will come. And our view, partly because it is so aggressive, has globalized, mostly in the form of this monetary economy that we invented in Europe in the 1200s. Not that money was invented there. Money is common in a lot of places. But the economy that we have with the way that it does things is a European invention. It says, among other things, there are banks. There's a role for banks, and that the major assets of banks are the debts of other people. So we try to keep everybody indebted to us, to this economy, to the financial institutions. It's really quite something when you look into it. And so in this very odd way, my relationship with this little owl, not only a portal into the natural world and the relationality of beings who live around us, but it opened a portal into seeing much more deeply into the history of human thought and why the thinking in our society is what it is, why it is that we let so much go with not only what's happened in you know, the sort of the history of things we call the environmental movement in my lifetime, all the pesticides, the pollution, the decline of species, the endangerment of species, but now with climate change and all the other problems that is causing, it is not evoking major alarm bells from the things that drive the economy and drive the way that we live. I used to think that, well, that's because we say that climate change is something that will happen in the future. So people say, well, it's not happening now, I don't care. But we had last summer, we couldn't see the sun outside the window here because of all the smoke from the wildfires in Canada, hundreds and hundreds of miles away. So much of Canada was on fire for about a month last summer. It was unprecedented. The fires on the West Coast, the fires in the Amazon, the fires in Australia. I personally know three couples who had their house burned to the ground in California. Are we doing things differently as a result of these emergencies and these intensified storms and floods? And so, no, we're not doing anything differently.
Yeah.
Really? The conversation is intensifying, but the actions are not catching up. We have people digging in, denying what reality and what's going on. We even have people looking forward to the end of the world and loving these signs that the world will collapse or explode because they can't wait to get off the world, which is, of course, psychotic, right?
Yeah, well, of course, yes. I mean, that is the issue, that we have a psychotic system in the sense of a divide, a deep divide, that there is the actual relational world we depend on, and there is the artificial ecology we built on top of it, which sucks away from it, but which we're embedded in through this kind of mind trick. And that's actually where Plato's helpful. I mean, so I'm a person. We won't go into this in detail.
Tell me how he's helpful. You can help me see some things maybe that I don't see about him.
Yeah. Well, I will say
I think he's a disaster. But I'd love to know what I may have missed.
Well, the first thing is to understand that when we read Plato today, we're reading it as we've decided we're going to read it, not as Plato taught it. So as far as the issue, the general issue that we find in any philosophy, it doesn't matter what it is there's a term that we could use for it, spiritual materialism. And what that term indicates is that any politics, any philosophy, even science, whatever you've got as a practice, it can be turned toward the ends of deepening and furthering bondage, ignorance, violence. It's easy to pick on, say, Christianity, because clearly Jesus didn't say, go, you know, murder people in my name, right? So the Crusades are an easy example, but there is no philosophy that's ever been immune from this, even Buddhist philosophy, as we can see in World War II, with the way the Zen establishment actually gave arguments for why this was a good Buddhist thing to do, to go and, you know, dive bomb into an aircraft carrier, right, as a kamikaze pilot. So Plato is not going to be immune to people taking his teachings and doing what they want to do with it. But there are a few things to keep in mind without going into big detail, which we could do some other time. But for one thing, the central metaphor that Plato is offering us is the one we need right now, which is we are trapped in the matrix. And you got to get out of that. And the other reality we don't have to believe is something completely separate from this world. Plato, in fact, tells us if you want to measure your culture's level of rootedness and wisdom, love, and beauty, there's an easy way to do it. You look at the ecologies around that place where you live. Now, they had already gotten cities, but that's what he said. If you look outside your city and it's abundant and vibrant and full of life, and it sustains itself like that over time, so you know it's not just luck, then your city is probably rooted in wisdom. If you see degradation in the ecologies around your city, that means your city is not rooted in wisdom. So he's telling us that there's a synchronicity there. Of course, he's not a scientist. He doesn't know what it is exactly, but he's aware that there must be some kind of invisible connection between the wisdom that human beings can actually manifest and the ecologies that they depend on. He's also very clear that the teachings in the dialogues are metaphoric, and that his most important teachings are really not in there. So he's not saying, he never said, here it is, this is an analytical philosophy and you lay it out. My criticism would be just a little bit different, which is that there's a style of consciousness, and consciousness has an ontogeny, just like anything else does. And in our culture, we developed a conquest style of consciousness. We're not the only culture to have it. Other cultures have developed a conquest style of consciousness. That style of consciousness is much more likely to do the things that we do. And if you want a different style of consciousness, you have to have a different developmental path. And so I think that Plato can help us there, because I think he understands that we will become what we practice, and how we live is a function of our understanding of how life actually works. And then the final thing I would say is that, you know, there are still these beautiful ways, like when Gregory Bateson wrote Mind and Nature, he says, look, I'm laying out a Platonic view. And he was trying to say that there is a patterning that is not easy for us to see. It's not overt because it's nonlinear. It's subtle. The interwovenness of nature is subtle, but somehow we can come into attunement with it. And this must be a more subtle activity than our analytic science is used to, because like you, Gregory Bateson, he said, you know, well, when I'm in nature, this was back in the time when people were still using right and left brain in a sort of superficial way. He said, when I'm in nature, it's very right-brained. I'm not making the charts and graphs and ticking things off, but I'm really appreciating it in an aesthetic way. So those are, I mean, just some general things. So the people, I think there's so much value that Plato could give us to help the situation, but it would require just reading him better. And we don't know how to do that yet. But the scholarship is there.
That's interesting. To your point about if you look outside the city and what do you see, think about a hunter-gatherer society. They are constantly taking from nature. Nature is the only thing that they have, right? They're in it. They're in the natural world. They haven't really transformed anything. All of their implements are wood and stone and bone. They're you know, even into what few hunter-gatherers exist nowadays, they're living with a Stone Age culture, and everything that they do and need has to be taken from nature, but the nature continues around them. They never take enough to start breaking the system. Whereas our way of living relies on the destruction of nature, not just the use, but the destruction of nature. And those statements, they're sort of extreme, but they're you know, very largely true. And when I talk about this as a way of just illustrating, sometimes I've actually had people say, well, so you want us to all go live in the woods and get eaten by tigers? That's what somebody said to me recently.
It's so ridiculous. No, but please, go ahead.
That's, first of all, tigers don't live everywhere, so it's not even possible for us all to get eaten by tigers.
Right.
But no, of course, that's not at all what I'm talking about. But there are, for instance, there are indigenous people who are living in the modern world, like in British Columbia, in Canada, in Alaska, a few on the West Coast. They live in the modern world. They teach a very, very different relationship with the living world around them.
Yes.
They don't take everything they possibly can to squeeze the most money out of it for a few reasons. One is that they realize that they need a functioning system to continue to do what they're doing. They can't afford to wreck it. Whereas in our culture, moving along, because if you have distant markets and they don't care where they source from, they can wreck this place utterly, wreck the next place utterly. It works for them. Yeah. It doesn't work for land-based people.
No. Well, you know,
so
they can
have computer accounts. You can email them. They have chainsaws and outboard motors and stuff like that. But they're not destroying the basis of the world around them and their culture. That's the big difference.
Yeah. Well, also, I wanted to acknowledge that didn't you write it? Wasn't this, am I misremembering? But that in Beyond Words, you talk about how human beings have learned to live with tigers and made agreements, right? Or learned to live with lions, right?
That's very true. Yes.
And so
that's actually true.
Yes. Yeah. So we act like we couldn't do it, but people here lived with bears and wolves on Turtle Island. There were bears and wolves, and people lived with them just fine.
And the San in South Africa had some kind of understanding going on with the lions there. This is a really, really interesting thing that's it's not in Beyond Words. It's in the new book, Alfie and Me, where no one there could ever, when people first started, people from our culture first started to encounter and write about their culture, they learned that no one there could ever remember a lion killing a human being. Leopards did occasionally kill people. There was some kind of a different, weird co-understanding going on between them and lions, like there was in Eastern Russia with the native people there and the Siberian tigers. I personally find those things completely fascinating because I would love to understand the cognitive basis for not only that relationship, but how that relationship was perpetuated from generation to generation of those lions and those tigers. They must have been learning from their parents. What do you do when you encounter the scents and signs of people or vulnerable people? Why would you avoid them? What was the back and forth? In Eastern Russia, part of it was that human hunters would leave parts of what they killed for the tigers. The tigers seemed to understand that this was a cooperative relationship in some sense. Anyway, totally fascinating to me. I don't know what it would take to really get those answers, especially now that those relationships are so shattered.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's tragic. And it's interesting how differently we lose the sense of what's even possible. We have the sense, we've inherited the sense that, as Freud put it, the raison d'etre of civilization is to protect us from nature. As if we mm-hmm. couldn't even, we have so much protection and like we won't give up anything. And we want more and more and more. That's another thing that sort of resonates because I teach about eco-literacy and also I co-teach with another colleague eco-literacy and also the Earth Charter. And the Earth Charter has this line about having more versus being more. And that mm-hmm. is the Socratic imperative. That's what Plato taught us in the Apology, is that Socrates was asking us to think about how to be more rather than how to have more, even back then. You know, there's this
That's
kind of
really
sense
amazing.
Of the breakdown. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
That's very, very interesting. And let me point out one thing about Freud. You mentioned that he said that the rationale for civilization is to protect us from nature. And how strangely fearful that is that the civilization that he's talking about would, within that century, within his century, would destroy 150 million of its own citizens. The most civilized people in the world killed 150 million of the most civilized people in the world and destroyed their cities, etc. So the most violence and the most misery that the world has ever seen was part of Freud's generation, and he was afraid of nature.
Yeah, right. I know the beautiful irony, right? And it's so interesting how I added to the list of what we don't know. We don't understand how a lot of us wouldn't recognize food that, you know, something we could eat within 100 yards of where we live, assuming that we live in a place where food could grow. We might not recognize, say, you know, a certain plant that we could eat or whatever it might be, right? And so there's this lack of eco-literacy, even though ecology we should see as the queen of the sciences, as the most important science. And then there is this lack of recognition that our happiness and a certain degree of meaning of life are bound up with the natural world. So that's why I added that we don't know how to be happy or at peace. It's not just that we don't know how to live on a land base, but we don't know the beginning of that happiness and peace are right there. You don't have to go beyond 100-yard radius of your home to find happiness, right? And to find meaning and relationships across species boundaries.
Right. It's so true that I don't even know how to say it in a way that reveals all of the depth of that statement, but it's very, very true. I'll tell you one funny thing that's a little bit along with the point you just made about recognizing something that's edible. In my neighborhood, there are people who walk to each dandelion plant on their lawn and poison it. And I've read for a long time that dandelions are edible and that they're good in salad. And I've tried them a couple of times, and I think they tend to be too bitter for my taste. But I discovered a few years ago that if you sauté them, and we have some hens who lay eggs and wander around our yard all day, and if you sauté dandelion greens along with the eggs, it's as good as kale, but it's growing all over your lawn. You know, it takes no effort at all to have this stuff that is fine as food, and it tastes really good. We also have in our yard a spice bush that is a native plant, and the seed for it arrived from somewhere. You can walk right past them. They don't look like much of anything, but if you pull a leaf and you squash it a little bit, smells really, really beautiful. People used to make tea out of it. Well, guess what? You can still make tea out of it, and it's just really delightful. And these are just two things in my yard that most people would either want to do away with or wouldn't particularly notice. And they're right there for no effort at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Dandelions are such a great example because not only, I eat the greens, I like the greens, but you can make a tea out of the petals. And somebody once gave me a bottle of dandelion wine that they had made from the
Oh, really?
dandelion tusk. Yes, that was a little bit more of an acquired taste as far as I was concerned, but it was interesting just that you could do this, you know, and that, you know, like purslane grows a lot of places and people don't realize it's, you know, nutritionists think it's a fantastic thing to eat, right? And we just treat it like it's a weed. And what kind of a different education do we need? I think is part of the question. I mean, why don't we have a kind of ongoing ecological education? Of course, some schools are starting to try to do this. There are forest schools. There are schools that are trying to have a better relationship with nature. But it's quite telling about our culture that we actually don't make much of an effort to think about that and to think through it.
Well, if you think of in public schools, at least the ones that I know, you have arithmetic and mathematics at different levels each year. You might have a history at different levels for at least a few years. You might have English at different levels, but you never have anything about ecology as being more than like one little unit in one science class. It's not something routinely taught as a matter of course in public schools, that you'd have, you know, sixth grade ecology, seventh grade ecology, eighth grade ecology. And that, to me, that's the most important thing you could actually ever learn, because ecology is relationships. You need to know something about relationships in order not to ruin those relationships.
Yeah, and what's so interesting is that that's essentially how philosophy views us is as relational beings who can learn more skillful relationality. I mean, that's essentially what the study of philosophy. So I see ecology and philosophy really being totally intertwined. I mean, once upon a time, people were natural philosophers; they weren't scientists, and in a way, that's another viewpoint on what went wrong in the dominant culture is that we decided that knowledge was easier to get and better to have than wisdom. Wisdom is hard, you know? It's much more difficult to learn to live wisely with birds than it is to cut them open and say, "Look, now I know what all the parts are, and now I know what a bird is."
Sure, that certainly is true.
Yeah, I mean it's almost ironic because you mentioned Akhenaten and this kind of big kind of devastation to the history of religion, and one of the scholars who looks at so I've mentioned that the scholarship on the ancient Greeks has shifted. Pierre Hadot is one important scholar who has cautioned us that we have not been reading the ancient Greeks properly, but another one is Ujdavinis. Who says, well, you know, the scientists today are the Akhenatens. So, I mean, he really is almost reversing the argument is that really because they have said that we're the only ones, just like Akhenaten is the only one who could actually understand the divine. Science, in this more limited sense, has said we're the only ones who really understand the world. I'm not trying to belittle science, because there is, first of all, it's the gold standard of epistemology in our culture, and there's a cogency. And yet at the same time, the relationships that you're talking about go a little bit beyond, and that they would be part of what we would have to get from that progressive education, that it wouldn't just be the textbook. It would be, okay, how do you actually be with this world? And that's part of its importance, isn't it? Because it's not a theoretical subject. You're not defending it because I, Carl Safina, am an ecologist and I think my science is so cool, everyone should study it. But it is the science of how we live in this world. So are we living in the world or not?
No, that's right. It's the science of relationships. And obviously, I mean, I there are certain kinds of science and certain approaches to science that I have a big problem with, and others, other approaches and other kinds of sciences that I think are the most powerful thing the human mind has ever invented. It's a little bit like technology. Technology is everything from, you know, a spear to artificial intelligence. So what kind of technology are we talking about? What kind of science is helpful, and what kind of science is a problem? And it's what scientists bring, what values that come from elsewhere that they bring into their science. That's another thing that makes a big difference in their approach and what they're focusing on and why they think they're doing their work. Ecology is about relationships. And one of the big problems that we have is that our economy has helped to transform us from being relational beings into being transactional beings. If you're in a relationship, the relationship is two-way and ongoing. If you're in a transaction, you both get two different things and walk away. You have no further responsibility and no further relationship. And that's a recipe for breakage, right?
Yeah, and that's part of David Graeber's story of the history of debt, right? That debt in a more indigenous culture is meant to keep the relationship going. So that means that, so he critiques the kind of silly notion that we have that we invented money because I would come over and say, "Hey, Carl, you got these chickens laying eggs. You know, well, you know, here's some goat milk, and you give me five eggs, and I'll give you this thing of goat milk." And and Graeber said, nobody has ever found that to be true. Nobody's ever found evidence that ever existed. What happens is I come over and I say, "Hey, Carl, those are some nice looking eggs," and you say, "I'll take them," and you just give them to me. Now I'm indebted to you.
Right.
And so then you come over to my house or maybe I come back and I offer you more goat milk than you can drink. And it's sort of, I've given you more. So now I say, aha, I've turned the tables a little bit, but we both know that, oh, now you owe me a little bit more. Or I give you not enough. I give you a little bit of goat cheese and you say, hey, I gave you a dozen eggs. It was a little. So you don't actually say that, but we're registering that, oh, that's less than I gave. He's going to come back, I bet, and bring me something else. Yeah. And it keeps the thing going.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. A way I think, the way that I've come to see it and the way that I wrote about it in Alfie and Me is what you're talking about is what I call a gift rather than a transaction.
Exactly,
It's just words to describe these very different kinds of things. And Margaret Mead, when she first started her studies, her big discovery, as I remember being taught about it when I was in college, was that human societies, at least the ones she was studying, that kept the society together was reciprocity. That was her big concept, is that you do and you do back, and it's this thing that you're talking about. If I do something for you, then you kind of have to do something back at some point. It's not the same thing as, all right, I got, you got, now we don't have to do anything further with one another. We can just forget about it and leave. It's not like that at all. And the human mind still often functions that way. Just yesterday, I made a big pot of chowder and I texted a neighbor of mine down the street who, he's pretty new. He moved in a couple of years ago and we've kind of become friends. We like some of the same things. And I texted him and I said, would you like some chowder? And he said, oh, sure. So I went to his house with a quart of chowder, expecting nothing. I just wanted to give him a quart of chowder. And he had three things waiting on the counter to give me as this exchange. But it wasn't a transactional thing. I didn't say, I'll give you chowder if you have something for me. Exactly. But that's a way of keeping the friendship going. And we haven't been instructed to do this. It's just an impulse. It's a really beautiful thing that it can still function and it's still right there, just barely under the surface of most of what we do.
Yeah, it is. And the part of the reason I raised that point is that Graeber was making the exact same point you were on the other side, which is that modern debt is this thing that actually keeps us at a distance, and it is transactional. I mean, he was saying the same thing, that when you're done, that's it. That's the end of the relationship. I give you the right. money and I walk away.
Right.
And
right.
we don't actually strengthen the bonds between us. Mm-hmm. So we've been touching on a lot of the things that humans believe, but when you have that subtitle, What Owls Know, What Humans Believe. And belief, of course, that's a big issue in the wisdom traditions, that humans want to cling to their beliefs rather than trying to find out how things really are. And that's why we have to have a philosophical education, because we get the belief, we hold on to it, and we lose reality. What would you say are some things owls know and humans believe that we should reflect on in particular?
Well, a few things are that we tell ourselves that humans are the logical animal, and we're the only illogical animal. We're not the rational being. We're the only irrational being. We hold strongly, often, and sometimes violently, to things that are just not true or that we totally disagree about, because they can't all be true simultaneously if they differ so much and we disagree about them. There's a guy in New Hampshire, his name is Ben Killam, and he gets all of the bear cubs that are orphaned every year in the whole state of New Hampshire. When the authorities pick them up, they go to Ben Killam and his place, and he raises and rewilds these bear cubs. He's also dyslexic. He has trouble reading, and he said a very interesting thing to me. He said, language took human beings from being knowers to being believers. He sees the bears as creatures who learn things, and then they know the thing they've learned. They know where the food is, where the water is, who is dangerous, what is dangerous, how do you act socially. They know those things. But humans often just believe things. We believe things we're taught rather than knowing things that we experience. With the owls, they're total pragmatists. You know, they know their territory. They know their people, whether their people are us, the human beings who raise them, or the mates, or their young ones. They know what food is. They know where to find food. Those are all learned skills. Well, a lot of them are learned skills. And just like with us, it's a combination of instinctual capacities and what you learn on top of them. Like our language instinct doesn't determine whether we learn Greek or Vietnamese, but it does determine whether we can learn a human type of language with syntax and grammar. So I was, you know, so the thing is that the owls learn their world and they know their world, and the humans often don't learn their world, but they believe a lot of things about it.
Right. Yeah. And we don't realize how filled with abstract beliefs we are.
Right. Exactly. We often don't realize that. That's right. Especially when we insist that those abstract beliefs are facts, and we teach them that way.
Yeah. And this, too, is part of the Platonic program, is to get out of the beliefs, right? Because that's what Plato is basically telling us, is that everything, what we're seeing are shadows on the wall of a cave, where it's the matrix. We're embedded in a simulation. And the simulation is involved not only just to make us consumers, but we're also the consumed. That's another part of the matrix that sort of has become a reality, because we are being mined all the time for A, attention, which is this ethereal thing, but they want it, right? The structures of power that are operating the system. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, our information. Because we're being mined constantly for everything that we do. So the surveillance mm-hmm. capitalism idea, and just yeah. the general thing that even you can't even now go to the gas station and get gas without a video coming on, because we want to capture your attention.
I cannot stand that, really. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, so we're very much being consumed and we don't realize it. And we're consuming what we need to survive and don't realize it, as you point out. I mean, there's something... Do you think there's a sense... I mean, one of the things that's beautiful, too, about the story is that, of course, you were always already somebody who was attuned to ecology, but you're inviting people into the adventure of this relationship with another sentient being who, it's fair to say, you really came to care deeply about. And that activity of care and love is also very Platonic, because Plato said, if you want to get to wisdom, first admit you're ignorant. And love is the path that will get you there. Our job is to be here and take care of the world, to attend to the divine in the world. And that love is the path that will guide us to achieve the wisdom to be able to do this in the most effective way. Do you think that that's a fair part of the message, is that if we could start to find these relationships, we might start to care about these beings more, if we could start to see them as individuals sometimes even? Or as an expression of a deeper power?
I think that's very, very true. I think that seeing them as relational, seeing these relational beings as individual. For instance, after the story of Alfie and me that's in the book, Alfie is still around. I see her essentially every day. And her first mate, the one that's in the book, came back for 2 years in a row, but then he disappeared. Something happened to him. I don't know how old he was when he first showed up, but anyway, he was gone, and she got a new mate. So she skipped a year. She had no mate. She laid a clutch of infertile eggs, no young ones that year. It was very sad. And then last year, 2023, she had a new mate who just showed up again after his winter absence 2 nights ago, by the way, which is very, very happy for all concerned. But that new mate has such a different personality from the first mate that's one of the most instructive things, is that these are all individuals. So one way of looking at all of this that I find very constructive is relational beings, yes, they're individuals. But another way is we can be capable of just having a love affair with the world. We can be in love with life, the living world, the miracle of our existence, the incredible miracle of life on this planet. When if you look out at the rest of the solar system and the known universe, life is at the very least, it's extremely rare. Other things are not rare. There's gravity everywhere. There's light everywhere. There are atoms and many of the same molecules all throughout the universe. These things are the commonalities. Life is extremely strange and really miraculous. And here it is, self-perpetuating, self-proliferating, for billions of years into all of these forms and functions, all interrelating. I mean, it's completely overwhelming. And to take the little bit of it that you can get and comprehend and enjoy in a lifetime is completely astonishing. And, you know, that is the basis for a total love affair with existence. But who thinks of it that way when you need to get your car fixed and you have to stop and get groceries on the way home and you're trying to fill up your stupid vehicle and you have a screen blaring at you even then? It just blots out everything. There's a really, really different way of being in the world that is available to all of us. But we're not usually raised that way, and it takes some effort to like jump that track to where it sort of explodes as being so obvious.
Mm-hmm. That's where you got to take the red pill, get out of the cave, get out of Plato's cave, get out of the matrix. And it's not that far off, but you're right. It's interesting how it takes a disruption. And that too is part of the old way, the Greek way of thinking, is that it requires a rupture with the habit patterns that if the culture is diluted, it just indoctrinates you with habit patterns. And that's patterns of perception, ways of thinking, ways of talking, which you bring out too, that people might have referred to the bird as an it, but you wanted to try to give it a gendered pronoun, making your best guess of what it might be. And that there are all these little subtle ways. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's that idea that Robin Wall Kimmerer has brought out, that in some or maybe all of the North American native languages, and I suspect many other languages, especially indigenous ones, there was a language of animacy where a living thing had a different pronoun from a non-living thing. You might call a non-living thing it, like a rock, but you would not call a bird it. It would have a different pronoun that indicated its animacy, its aliveness. And we just treat everything as inventory in our language. The language gets in our way of our thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, speaking of language, I'll just say again, Carl's a beautiful writer. It's a great book to read. It's smooth reading, even while he's contemplating really deep, important, profound questions, and he handles them beautifully, everybody. So I really want to recommend this book again as a really good work of philosophy. Yeah, so I disagree about Plato, so you'd be just read that critically, my friends. But everything else is so wonderful, so it doesn't even matter. I don't care. And it's fine that you're right. We have inherited a certain misguided view, and that still does affect us. So the misguided views that you're describing are problematic beliefs that we have, and some of them are unconscious, that even if we intellectually say, oh, I don't believe in dualism or this or that, it's in there because of the ways that the culture gets us to move in this artificial matrix that is sort of living off the real world that we have to reconnect to. So,
right,
Carl,
right. I was speaking to somebody recently who was anyway, just to make a long story short, he said, I don't care what the ancient Greeks had to say. Okay, well, in a sense, who does? But the fact is, we're living what they had to say. We don't even know that they're in our minds. We're still bobbing in the sea of thought that they created.
Yeah, it's important. But I also, as I said several times, I think they also can help us get out of this crazy. Mm-hmm. So that's the beauty, is that it's not all misguided. A lot of what they have to offer us will, I think, can help us reconnect with the world. And Carl's work can too, friends. So please read it. Read everything this guy's written. It's good stuff. And I want to thank you, Carl, for joining us. It's just really great to talk to you.
It was a terrific conversation with you. Yes, you're a very informed guy, and you know what you're talking about, and that's not very common. So I appreciate that.
Oh, well, I appreciate you, and I appreciate all of you, friends. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions, reflections, stories you want to share, send them in. Maybe we could get Carl back. If you ask good questions, people will come back. So please send it in through dangerouswisdom.org. We might be able to bring some of that into a future contemplation. There's a series on ecological thinking that's happening in and around this interview, so look for that. We already released the first episode. That's an important series given everything that we talked about. How can we think a little bit more of the way nature works, as Bateson invites us to? So check that out as well. Until next time, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. Take good care of them.